Hi, today is November 28th, 2015. This is Mobius Podcast number 139. I'm Todd Ogasawa with my good friend John Westfall and our special guest, Frank McPherson, who was on this podcast with me back in podcast number 2 on November 28th, 2008. So this podcast is 7 years old. Not exactly today. Actually, there were a couple of earlier podcasts, but it was in November 2008. So, you know, sometime this month was our 7th year anniversary. The podcast has actually gone through a couple of names. It was, I think, the Mobile Today podcast, part of the time, and other part of the time is the Media Bistro Mobile Something podcast, because I was splitting it with a couple other folks. I mean, it's my podcast, but by splitting it, I mean, I was trying to do like a couple of different series. But in any case, although, and if I go back and count, it might be like Windows. It might not actually be Windows number 10. This might not actually be podcast 139, but I'll go back and do the math someday and figure it out. Anyway, John, Frank, thanks for joining me once again. And we asked Frank here because A, he was available today, and B, again, it is exactly 7 years since he and I did our first podcast together. And back then, we talked about the T-Mobile G1, which is the first Android phone available in the U.S. In fact, I think it was available anywhere. I think it had whatever name it was in Europe and so forth. But it was released in September 2008, so it was just a month old when Frank came on podcast number 2 to discuss it. And I had already returned mine because the battery life was so bad it didn't last until lunch. I didn't think I would always be able to charge it during lunch. I mean, there are some days you're not by a charger during lunch. I think Frank...
And I had yet to buy mine. I didn't buy mine until, I think it was spring of the next year at the MVP Summit. I got to play with one of our fellow MVPs had. And I thought, that looks really cool. So I went home and bought one. And basically, Android was my daily driver for a number of years after that. So.
Really?
Yeah, I'm very curious to hear kind of what your... Because the impressions looking over the kinds of things that we've been looking at for preparation of today's notes, I experienced a lot of the same things a few months later, but it is interesting to have had that right out of the gate experience that you guys had.
Yeah. So, Frank, let me just recap what we talked about 7 years ago. First of all, we discussed the fact that you got one, and I had returned mine. I asked you what your current favorite apps were, and there was one called Locale, which I can't remember. I think it did something. It was kind of like IFTTT. I think it did something based on where you were, and the Weather Correct. Channel app. And I asked you what you're hoping to see in the future, and you said Evernote, eWallet, and eReader, so you kind of got one of them.
No, I get two, actually. eWallet is available for Android.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
And eReader actually became the Barnes & Noble Nook app.
Is that right?
Yep. eReader was, I think, acquired by Barnes & Noble. And some of the, well, effectively, the Nook replaced it. But it reads, it was able to access that PDB file format that the e-reader used for their books. So when Barnes & Noble first released that reader, that was the reason why I went with them initially, so I could carry over my library of books I had with e-reader.
Now, e-wallet for Android, is it still available and you still use it?
It is available, but I do not use it. Okay. It did not become available for quite some time, and I found an app called B-Folders, which I still use today. It's as an equivalent, secure encrypted wallet type, really kind of a local database app that encrypts its data files. And if I want to store secure information locally on my device, I use B-Folders. For a lot of my user IDs and passwords, I now use LastPass.
Now, were you able to move your encrypted data from eWallet to B-Folders, or was that a manual process?
No, as I recall, I moved it. It was basically a file export to a CSV file format.
Okay, that's pretty reasonable.
So it was pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Now, back then, I asked you also, going through a couple of things we discussed, is what you thought about Android app pricing, which at the time was a little bit higher than iPhone apps. I think now that's not true anymore. They're pretty much, first of all, most Android apps are free. And the ones that do have a price attached to them are about the same price as the typical iPhone app, 99 cents to a couple of dollars. So,
We do forget that when Android first kind of launched, the app developers on Android thought, well, this is just the same as iOS. Right. And so a lot of the good apps at the beginning were all paid. And then right around 2010, mid-2010, around then was when you started seeing developers figure out, hey, if I put out an ad version of my app, it makes more money than the paid version. And yeah. I remember that we went through kind of the great exodus of the paid versions dying.
Right.
And being told just to upgrade to the ad version. Sorry, you've got ads now, but we're not going to support this ad-free version.
Well, I think the other thing is that the data that indicated that, in general, Android users bought fewer apps or were less likely to buy an app than iPhone users, who are actually likely to spend 99 cents to, you know, $2 or so to buy an app, or more likely to buy it, I should say.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about this conversation is that if you think back to 7 years ago and the way things were, Apple, when they first released the iPhone, did not have an app store for it in 2007 when the iPhone was first released.
Mm.
It wasn't until a year later, July of 2008, I believe,
yeah,
that Apple released the iTunes App Store. So at the time that T-Mobile started selling the G1, and essentially we got to use Android for the first time, and Android, that initial version came with what was known then as the Android Market, what we now know today as the Play Store. The idea of an app store was very much a new thing. And obviously buying apps for smartphones was kind of a newer thing. Prior to that, you know, people, if they had a Palm, there were certainly numbers of apps for Palm, but obviously a very wide variety of free apps that were available through the internet. And the same thing for Windows Mobile, Pocket PC, and so forth. So the app store was kind of a new concept. And as we now know today, it's still a very much a differentiator between the iPhone and the Android platforms because of Apple's controlling approach to the iTunes App Store and trying to control the quality of the apps. The one can debate that. And the somewhat more open nature of the Android stores, the Play Store that exists today.
You know, I wonder, and maybe you guys can refresh my memory, but my recollection is back then, or a little earlier, you know, 2006, 2007, there weren't that many free apps for Windows Mobile. I mean, I remember paying $15, $10, $20 for you know, Windows Mobile apps.
There weren't that many good free apps. There were a lot of free apps in my recollection, but the apps that everyone talked about and the apps, you know, for a number of years, I remember, I think it was 2 or 3 years, I was one of the judges for Smartphone and Pocket PC magazines, you know, App Awards, and I remember looking at some of those apps and looking at what was written about at the time, and those were the apps that were $10-$15,
mm-hmm.
and they were worth, you know, what we consider they were worth it now, although today, $10-$15 on an iOS or an Android app, the thing better start printing money out of the SD card slot or something like that. You know, it's one of those things where it's a really strange perspective shift we've had in the last 7 years, where all of a sudden we expect mobile app prices to be consistent with what we paid for a song on iTunes. That was
That's pretty much it, isn't it?
Well, and a perfect example of that is the eWallet app that we just talked about. When I bought that for Windows Mobile Pocket PC, I believe it cost me $20.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Now, the other upside to that was that I got new versions of eWallet for free. I mean, I paid $20 once, and then each year, whatever they release new versions, I don't recall paying for new upgrades to that. But in contrast, I believe when eWallet first started selling for the iPhone, I think it sold for, it might have either been $4.99 or $10 at most.
It was kind of expensive.
So right off the get-go, they had to cut the price in half from what they sold initially.
Yeah.
And although I don't even know if they charge for it today, to be honest. Yeah.
Although it's still a lot more expensive than most other apps at the time, which were, $1, $2, $3.
Well, two notes on that I can remember. I remember eWallet in mid-2000s. They did actually charge per major upgrade, but I think they only had one major upgrade in from like the 2005 to 2010 time span. They were on like version 6 or something like that forever. So I do know when I used to be an editor for Pocket PC Thoughts that occasionally we'd be reporting that eWallet had come out with a new paid upgrade, but it was very, very rare in those last few years. So it wasn't just like your login credentials or your license credentials always worked, but it certainly seemed like that at that point. And the second thing, you know, we take for granted now that the web services we have should just provide a free app. You know, the idea of Evernote kind of providing a free app, Amazon providing a free app, all of those things 7 years ago, we wouldn't have batted an eye if they said, hey, you know, you want to use Amazon on your phone, we've got this mobile optimized version and it costs 99 cents. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have seemed that crazy, although today, if there's a new web store or something like that that says, hey, you got to buy our app for 99 cents, we look at it and go, yeah, right, I'm not going to buy anything from you. Sorry.
Mm. Yeah, it has changed quite a bit. And I remember they had weird prices in the Android market back then. They were like $1.29, $1.43. Some of it was because of euro conversion, but you know, they didn't control the pricing the way the Apple controlled the App Store pricing.
Yeah, the Android version of eWallet today costs $9.99, okay, which is a fairly expensive app for Android.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For any app, yeah. And, you know, I'm okay with vendors charging whatever the heck they think is if they can stay in business, you know, draw enough customers to stay in business. Because the worst thing, you know, we've seen a number of apps that have just simply come and gone, or companies that are, you know, basically in failure mode now because they didn't price correctly, or even our, you know, our mutual, and by mutual I mean all three of us, one of our mutual favorite services, Evernote, which apparently is having some hard times right now. So
you know, one of the weird things I think about now in comparison to 7 years ago, the most expensive software I've been buying in the last few years has been software that takes something that I was using the cloud for and puts it back on local storage, or, you know, local storage, or maybe Dropbox. Things like 1Password. I switched from LastPass to 1Password, and it does all its syncing through Dropbox. The banking software I use, I switched off Mint.com and went to a banking software solution that just stores things locally and then syncs through. It can sync through a number of things. It has its own cloud, but it could also sync through Dropbox. And I'm thinking, now I'm paying a premium to get things out of someone's cloud because I'm worried their cloud might not stick around.
That's a valid concern.
Something 7 years ago, if you said you had a cloud, I figured you knew how to price your cloud and that your cloud would be an option for me. And if it was free, I thought, wow, you must be making money off of ads or something like that. It never would have crossed my mind that you're just not making money.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, and you know, we forget if you were on that podcast, but a bunch of us are talking about the Microsoft, who, you know, has a few dollars in a bank, getting rid of their unlimited OneDrive service just a few weeks ago.
That one.
So even Microsoft has to rethink storage and pricing and or lack of pricing and what it really means. Okay. Moving on. The biggest thing, when I asked Frank the biggest issue that he had back then with the G1 in 2008 was memory management, overall storage, which was not too big, and I'll go through some specs in a minute, and battery life, which is of course the reason I returned my G1. It just, you know, like I said, it would last till about lunchtime, and then, you know, get to about 15% battery, and at that point I had to recharge or not have a phone. So and, you know, the funny thing is, until now, I think battery life has been one of the biggest banes of any Android user's life. I mean, it's gotten better. You know, it doesn't die at lunch anymore. But it certainly wasn't the kind of battery life I was seeing on an iPhone. Until now, the recent Marshmallow's Android 6.0 update on my Nexus has changed the way I think about battery life on Android devices, at least for my Nexus 6, which is, you know, last year's model. It will now it will now be at well over 50% when I plug it in before I go to sleep at night.
Yeah, and when you factor that, I have very much the same experience with my Nexus 6P. And when you combine the better battery management in Android 6 with the fast charging capabilities of the USB-C chargers that ships with it, I mean, basically now I don't worry about having to have my device fully charged. And, you know, leaving it plugged in overnight, I top it off whenever I have time. Where prior, religiously, I had plug in my phone when I went to bed at night so it would be charged up and ready for me to go in the morning. I don't, you know, the 6P now, I don't even think of it that way. I just take it up to bed and leave it in my bedstand without plugged in and get up and go. And usually if I'm driving into the office, I plug it in during the drive. And by the time I get to the office, it's topped off to 100%. So, yeah, very, very much improved from version 5 to 6, and in the context of our conversation now, dramatically improved from when it was first released in 2007.
Yeah, I think Android 6.0's battery management software is a game changer. It really makes Android a much more practical device. I mean, it obviously it's practical for most of the world. It's the dominant mobile OS. But I think Android users who never used the iPhone didn't realize that their phones could really last all day without any issues or anything until now.
We forget that when Google kind of rolled out Android, Android was more of a full operating system than iOS even is today. And so it's not very surprising that it treated the battery like it was treating a laptop battery. And I think that was what really was the problem, was that the, you know, early versions of Android really had no battery management. They just kind of used the battery, and a rogue app could take up as much battery, you know, could churn away and do as much as it wanted in the background. So with better memory management and more storage and, you know, all of it kind of came together to give us better battery life today. But it is kind of funny. Those first Android devices just kind of treated all of their resources as if they were limitless, as if it was on a desktop or laptop computer and not as if it was on a mobile device.
Yeah, and I think the biggest part area where that was the case is network connectivity. And bear in mind, I think one of the big differences between the Android G1 and the iPhone is that the G1's predecessor, which was the Danger Hip Top, in its genesis is really net connectivity, you know, being access to the internet and then ongoing communications. And the notification model that kind of came with that and evolved with that and what we see in Android today meant that it's like constantly talking on the network and constantly receiving communications. And that has a big impact on battery life. The iPhone, Apple was smart, I think, in trying to really control that, in saying, you're right, battery life is important. We need to really control how much apps access the network, because that can be a very battery-consuming activity. So they controlled a lot of that communications in the very beginning. It was much more locked down, if you will, in that way, and that helped battery life a lot. And that comes, I think, a bit from its genesis, which is really more tied to an iPod. And it's, you know, an elegant device. It has network connectivity. If I remember right, when Steve Jobs first introduced the iPhone, he really kind of talked about it as, you know, this is like an iPod that can do much more, because it can also be a phone and it can also access your email. And, oh, yeah, you can also get onto the public internet with it. So a very different beginning, starting point for the two different platforms. And I think you see that through it. Its entire, you know, in these past 7 years, how it's been developed.
You know, speaking of Android,
and the thing I would just add to that is, when iPhone came out, it was basically an evolution of iPod. In fact, iPod, I just watched the keynote for the first iPhone a few weeks ago, and you know, Jobs talks about the three things it can do, and one of them is it's an iPod, and the other was that it could do internet, and then there was something about PIM data and stuff like that.
It's a computer.
Yeah. And but it was very much, this is a connected device. It is not a replacement for a computer. Whereas Android, you know, I remember one of the things that really hooked me on it in version 1.0, 1.5 was just how cool they could do things to it. You know, just you could do stuff on an Android phone that was tantamount to what you were doing on a Linux computer at that time, because that's basically the people who were writing for Android were, you know, Linux geeks who said, well, why can't I do this or this or this? I don't care if it takes up 1,000 cycles or takes up half the battery. So it's a very different genesis, as Frank pointed out a few moments ago, between Android and iPhone. So it's very interesting how they basically have kind of merged toward each other over the last 7 years.
Yeah, you know, something I wanted to mention more on Marshmallow than the G1 is that up until recently, on my Nexus 6, which is, you know, one generation behind Frank's 6P, it does not have a USB-C thing, so you know, I can't quick charge, or at least not like a USB-C device, I guess. But I do have a key charger, and it, I put a case on my, after I put a case on my Nexus 6, I could no longer use wireless charging because apparently the case is too thick. So that's something to consider. The other thing is that in communications in general, is that in somewhere around five, well, actually, I don't know because I got the 6 only recently, but somewhere in Android 5.0, Wi-Fi stack got really broken badly, and so it would often lose communication with Wi-Fi just sitting around, not moving, just sitting around, and at the same time it would break my LTE connection. So I would be sitting around with a phone that had actually no communications at all sometimes. I would, you know, turn on the phone and I would see little exclamation points next to the Google Fi and next to the Wi-Fi thing, which is kind of annoying, but in 6 that seems to be fixed, at least so far, you know, knock on wood. But we'll see. We'll see.
You're
what
so
else.
You're so demanding, Todd. You want your connected device to be connected in some way.
All that's the time. Just, all the
that's
time.
That's really, really demanding of
I know. You know, I'm fussy that way. I really am.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, Todd, is that the last thing that you asked about, I think, was really, you know, what did I like about using the G1 back then? And I really cited that probably the most attractive thing was being part of something new.
Yeah.
Being on the bandwagon of the new operating system that was announced. And that was very much true in the case. I think a corollary to that was probably the openness that we're kind of touching on a little bit. And I know people will debate upon whether Android is open or not, given some of the requirements for the Google apps and the Play Store and so forth. But it, one, I think, cannot deny that there is two different approaches to these mobile platforms. You know, Apple, like I said, a little more controlling because they're really trying to provide an optimal experience for the user in concert between software and hardware on their devices. Where Google and Android has a bit more of that openness feel to it, really trying to emphasize access to the internet, which to me is access to information. And for my uses and for what I use these devices for, that Google approach more closely aligns to what I find most attractive, as opposed to maybe really elegant hardware or, frankly, maybe even the longest battery life. I've tolerated less battery life and some maybe what some people would consider very frustrating and almost showstopper types of things, because I've been very much invested in the Google approach, whether it's their apps or the access to the internet, later Google Now, and some of the voice interaction that they provide today.
Well, you know, Frank, I remember back then, I think you already had it in November of 2008. You had a giant humpy battery pack plugged into your G1
I've used a variety of extra battery things. It's clearly I was much more tolerant than the average person with things like battery life.
And it also says a lot, because the iPhone, of course, never ever allowed you to change the battery, right? I mean, that's something, it's a sealed system. Whereas the G1 had a removable battery, it had a SD slot, which I'll go into in a second because that's actually kind of interesting. But
you know, truth be told, with battery life, I'm not so sure the battery life of the iPhone, while in contrast to, say, what we're talking about with G1 was much better, I don't recall it being a world beater per se. It seems to me, in my memory recollection, that Apple really started getting battery life good around the time they launched the iPad. It seemed that whatever they did with iOS when they around the iPad launch time at the very beginning, they really turned a corner in terms of battery life. At least that's my recollection.
Well, you know, after I returned the G1, I went out and I bought an iPhone 3G, which was actually the second iPhone. So 3G indicated that it was, instead of being edge only, it actually had, you know, a 3G. Wireless network capability, not the version number as the numbers now do. But in any case, the 3G's battery lasted me all day. And by all day, I mean, you know, I would unplug it in the morning and take it, you know, to work. And at lunchtime, it'd be fine. And I'd come home and it might be at, I don't know, 40, 50%, you know, by the time I got home at 6 p.m. or so. But I never felt like I had to charge it in the middle of the day unless I was doing something really unusual. If I was traveling and taking a lot of photos, for example, and then uploading them, that would chew up the battery, of course. But aside from that, I remember it lasted all day for me, as did all the other iPhones.
Of course, our BlackBerry friends would laugh at that, right? Because they were used to phones lasting days.
Days, right.
If I recall.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but they also were used to their phones looking like they came straight out of 1994. So... You know, there's trade-offs of this. I mean, if you're willing to have a phone that looks like no one's decided to do anything with the OS for years, then you can have battery life for days and days.
Well, you know, for that group at the time, and I would say that time would be from about 2006 to 2008 until BlackBerry collapsed after that, it really did serve its user base quite well. I mean, basically, these people were doing email. That's all they really wanted.
Yep.
Secure email 24/7. And that's what they got. And they had a pretty good keyboard, a physical keyboard that, you know, BlackBerry users loved. And it was one of the things I had a hard time with, which is why I went with a G1 instead of an iPhone to begin with, because I thought I would love the G1's keyboard. It turns out I didn't. or at least not enough to offset the battery life. But
well, one of those things were important. That we're talking about with battery life and SD cards, I know you're going to move there in a moment,
yeah.
But... I had the humpy back battery for the G1 as well. I had a spare battery for the G1. And I had spare batteries for every Android device that I owned that it would be sitting in my bag. And, you know, they didn't always have to come out because I kept the thing on charge all day at my desk. But occasionally they did. And then talking about SD cards, really the thing that kind of chased me away from Android, the thing that I saw the writing on the wall and said, you know what, if I'm going to lose that, I might as well seriously consider iOS, was when we lost removable batteries and we lost reliable SD card slots being on the device. And I remember talking with a mutual friend of ours, Todd Jason Dunn, who, you know, told me when he was working at HTC at the time, he said, yeah, those things are just on the way out. You just have to accept that. You're not going to have a removable battery. You're not going to have an SD card slot.
Check it over.
And I thought, well, yeah. And I thought, well, then maybe I should seriously consider switching to iOS. And that's kind of what I ended up doing. So it's interesting how the open view of Android was so it was really open when you considered you could have those weird extended batteries that you popped into the regular terminals and you got, you know, more than a whatever milliamp battery, or you could upgrade, you could swap SD cards in and out and have, you remember people would boot whole different versions of Android
yep.
off of SD card. And, you know, my phone is running this version today, tomorrow, well, this version wasn't running too good, maybe tomorrow I'll pop in the old version and see how that runs.
Well, I think that echoes what Frank was saying, that, you know, why he likes Android is because it's very much like Windows PCs, right? It lets you, at least old Windows PCs, it lets you add in cards and add apps in. It has a real file system that any app can access should it want to.
And the real irony is that with Android 6 may have the best support for external storage
than
any prior version of Android, and you cannot buy an Android phone from Google that actually has external storage support or
That's
SD
right.
cards.
Because Jason Dunn was right.
Oh, that is a horrible, horrible world, but he'll He'll be happy to hear
well,
that.
It is an interesting, it is kind of an interesting debate. I, in all honesty, I think I'm inclined to think the SD card debate is really something that geeks are concerned about and the average user is less concerned about, mainly because of the fact that today most media is being stored in the cloud. I mean, with the difference in data plans and the cost prices, really relative to the way things were in 2007, I stream music off of Spotify. So I hear, if I'm going to listen to music on my phone, I just stream it. My pictures that get automatically uploaded to Google Photo, to Flickr, and could go to just about any place else I wanted to automatically. They don't need to stay on my device as long as I can have access. And frankly, I have internet access just about anywhere I go. So external storage for me, yes, that was something I really looked for. Frankly, that's why I picked the Pocket PC platform over Palm back in the days, really because of its support for PC cards and, later compact flash cards and so forth. That was an important thing, but I fell into the drinking the Kool-Aid that Jason was dishing out. It's not an issue for me anymore, frankly.
And I think the difference is back then, phones in general did not have a lot of storage, either RAM or flash memory. And in fact, on Android devices I used subsequently, like the Nexus One, for example, and the Droid, the Motorola Droid, that was the bane. As apps got bigger and bigger, I couldn't update apps anymore. In fact, I had to start removing apps just to update the apps I really wanted to use. I think at one point I had to remove everything because I couldn't even update the system apps that held, most half were in firmware and the rest were on the storage card. And that was the end of that. That was time to move to the next phone, a little bit more storage.
And unfortunately, like I was just alluding to with the changes with Android 6, right? Even if in prior versions of Android, even if you were lucky to have a phone with SD card support, you were really had difficulties, it's practically impossible to get the apps to actually install on those SD cards. So you still had that constraint of the internal storage to the issue you were having, Todd, right? Of either getting apps installed or upgrading the operating system.
Right.
Which is why selling devices today with just 16 gig of storage space in it, when that storage gets dramatically decreased by the time it comes out of the store because of the operating system and all the crapware that gets put on there by the sellers of the device, is ridiculous. No device today should have less than 32 gig, and hopefully, we're probably not too far in the future where 64 gig will become the minimum.
Yeah, in fact, at Apple, essentially 64 gigs is the minimum because they don't have a 32. And people who are smart enough or have friends that are smart enough to tell them not to buy the 16 gig because it's too darn small. So they essentially start at 64 now. The other thing I wanted to mention is that although some apps could be installed on SD card back then, and back then is like 2008, 2009, ironically, the one set of apps that could never be installed on SD card were Google's own apps. None of them could be moved or initially installed on an SD card. They all resided in system memory or in system flash, which drove me nuts because they were bloated and giant often. Let's see, where are we?
You just have silent agreement on all parties.
Anyway, I just wanted to, for those folks who don't remember the T-Mobile G1, I just wanted to rattle off a couple of key specs that I grabbed from gsmarena.com. The first thing I mentioned earlier is that it had a QWERTY keyboard, a sliding keyboard, which is okay. It wasn't great, it turned out. I kind of had a hard time typing on it.
When it launched, that was its only keyboard.
Yeah.
We forget that the soft keyboard didn't come along until 1.5, which came out in 2010, mid-2010.
But what it did have, and I loved, and I really didn't want to get rid of, was the trackball button. So back when Android still had a main button for menus, kind of like Apple's, the G1 not only had a button, it was a trackball, a functional trackball, which I thought worked great for maneuvering around the screen, especially for maneuvering in text screens like email where you wanted to correct. You had a little typo, you just wanted to quickly maneuver your cursor over it and fix it. It was great, and I wish it would come back.
Yeah, interestingly enough, the very first Nexus One device that was manufactured by HTC.
Yeah.
Some people would think this is probably the best Nexus that was ever made. It had that little trackball.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yep. I have a Nexus One.
Yep.
Yep. That was a great phone. It
not only had the trackball, but the trackball lit up as an LED.
Wasn't it tricolor?
You could program this to have different colors for different types of notifications.
Yeah. I miss physical buttons on Android phones in general, and I really, really miss having a menu button. I really wish it were a trackball menu button. I still think it would be valuable to most of us who, you know, want to do email and are not perfect typers and need to fix little typos before we send out emails. It would be great to have that. The other thing that may blow people's minds who, you know, are used to 1080p displays in their phones is the G1 had a 3-inch display, which is half of what your Frank's new 6P is, essentially. A little more than half, but about half. And a 320 by 480, what is that, QVGA, quarter VGA display?
Mm-hmm.
320 by 480 pixel display, which would be basically like a stamp on your current Nexus device. Hard to believe. 192 megabytes of RAM. Micro SD slot is, as Frank mentioned, a 3-megapixel camera, which is actually it was an camera, especially compared with the iPhone was doing at the time. And Bluetooth only supported headsets. That's all they could talk to back then. No external keyboards, no mouse, no nothing else. And as I mentioned earlier, terrible battery life. But
yeah, the keyboard was a slider. Well, yeah. Actually, the screen was a slider, right? Basically, it was set up for a landscape orientation, so you would push up the screen away in holding the phone as landscape, and then you would have that full-size keyboard that you could type. It was very much, again, if people would Google the hip top danger,
yeah,
or it was known as the T-Mobile Sidekick,
yep,
that was the forefather of the G1. And, you know, the interesting history back then, you know, people may recall that at the time that all this was happening in 2006 through 2008 when the iPhones was being developed and Google was doing their stuff with Android, you had the head of Google, and I'm forgetting the name at the moment, who was actually on the board of Apple, and there was this whole issue about, you know, was Google...
Eric Schmidt,
whether, yep, they were trading inside information to see what was going on in development. And Steve Jobs was famously was really mad about the fact that Google was coming out with Android. They thought they had an agreement that Google apps were going to be on the iPhone for search and, you know, hopefully in the future, Gmail and other things. And then lo and behold, they find out about this phone that's being developed. And I got to imagine that at some point in time when Steve actually saw the G1, it was kind of like, oh, well, that isn't such a big deal after all. Because I'm pretty confident my iPhone looks a little bit better. And things kind of settled down because that G1 wasn't as much of a touchscreen type of phone like the iPhone was. It had that physical keyboard. It had that little trackball. So it looked different. It acted different. And so it was less of an issue. It wasn't until, you know, later iterations of Android and the Android devices like the Nexus One that I just alluded to that started to look more like the iPhone, that now things started to become even more problematic for Steve and the folks at Apple, because it was looking, you know, very similar in their perspective. And, you know, that led to some, even to this day, the competitive nature between the two companies.
Well, and it's interesting to also think about how at the time, I can totally see Steve Jobs looking at the G1 and saying, well, this was made by those same guys who were doing the T-Mobile Sidekick, the Danger folks. And I bet it's completely worthless without an internet connection, because the Sidekicks were completely worthless without an internet connection or a data connection of some sort. They were basically, you know, that's why they appealed to the youth demographic. They were for texting and the early versions of MMS and that sort of deal. But you couldn't do any real work on them. And so if that was kind of the impression was, well, this thing won't be any kind of work powerhouse. It'll just be kind of a cool toy. Sure, let Google go off and develop it. And then about 2 years later, once we start getting into the Nexus devices, all of a sudden Android can actually be used for productivity, which is probably, I think this is one of Apple's greatest underestimations of a product line, was probably the underestimation of Android.
You know, and a little side note, I didn't put in our show notes for discussion, but ironically, Microsoft bought Danger later, which meant they owned a Sidekick line. They had a tremendous, tremendous data storage failure in the cloud, specifically for the Sidekick service. The Sidekick had no local storage, so many people lost everything. No contacts, everything were gone because everything was stored in the cloud. There was nothing local to retrieve from. And the backup system, a dangerous backup system, also failed.
Yeah.
So it was... It was just ironic because I think Microsoft was obviously trying to figure out what the heck to do to work against Android and iPhone, which was eating away into Windows Phone. And for those who don't remember, Windows Mobile, at least, this is pre-Windows Phone. Windows Mobile in 2008 had about 20% of the market. I know this sounds amazing now that it has like 1% of the market, but Windows Mobile... the phone side of it was actually one of the dominant smartphones in the market. I think it basically was BlackBerry, Windows Phone, and then maybe Nokia was third in the U.S. at least. In other places in the world, it was different.
Yep, and again, we touched on this, but back in 2008, keyboards were very much a big topic about these mobile devices. And BlackBerry at the time was thought to be the device with the best physical keyboard.
Yes.
And most people accepted that you had to have a physical keyboard in order to have a device that you could do any type of input in. And so when Apple introduced the iPhone without a physical keyboard, and Steve, you know, was up there claiming and trying to convince people, well, listen, with its predictive capabilities and everything, if you just trust it, you will be able to type on this screen as fast as you would with a physical keyboard. And I think most people at the time were very skeptical of whether or not that is the truth. And even today, things have advanced as much as it is. But even today, I think one could have that debate. And I think that the most sure sign of how people have accepted the value that you get from it, they just tolerate the deficiencies, is if you just Google autocorrect errors, you will find websites that are, you know, they're out there that exist purely to show very humorous autocorrect changes to text, to messages, instant message, and those types of things that are just hilarious. I mean, you could spend a ton of time just laughing at the way things corrected. And probably back in 2007, 2008, people would find that totally unacceptable. You know, I would never use a device like that that does that. I want a physical keyboard where that can't possibly happen to me.
And of course,
today,
one of those,
just live with it.
One of those popular add-ons for phones and tablets is a physical keyboard, a third-party physical keyboard.
Certainly for tablets, the phone side's kind of debatable, right? You got BlackBerry right now that's trying to survive by selling their latest device, which is again another slider device that slides up in a portrait orientation with a keyboard underneath it.
Yeah, Priv, yeah.
Yep.
Which runs Android.
Correct.
Yeah.
But they're still hanging on to that keyboard as their main selling point.
I think that's okay for them though, because they're loyal, you know, fans of the 1%. I think they even have a less of a market share than Windows Phone right now. They want a keyboard.
But I don't know if they can survive under loyal fans. They
I don't
need
know
to
either.
Expand the market to survive.
Yeah, they don't have the kind of cash reserves Microsoft does.
We've grown to tolerate the deficiencies of an on-screen keyboard, basically. You know, either I send a text message and it has spelling errors and autocorrect errors, and I either laugh it off or I just move on. Back in 2008, I think most people would just not tolerate that. That's not acceptable. So,
you know,
and here's a weird sort of thing that I don't think either of you have this perspective, because it's truly only one that someone who's been teaching 18, 19, and 20-year-olds over the last 10 years has had. In 2005, 2006, spelling was atrocious in the essays I would get from 18-year-olds. I saw text speak, you know, you instead of Y-O-U and improper capitalization, and just it was a distracting mess. Now I lament the fact that my students love to try to do everything on their phones. They don't want to turn on an actual computer anymore, and they can't use certain websites that I have them using because they're trying to do it on a phone, and I have to keep sending them emails saying, listen, don't do this on a phone. Use a real computer for it. But they're using autocorrect. And strangely enough, I'm not seeing, even in their written work, the same sorts of shorthand and leet speak and everything else I used to see. So there's this weird effect going on with autocorrect in that people are no longer having, at least in that 18 to 20-year-old age range before they get real jobs and get fired for it, they aren't having that same sort of comfortableness with the shorthand that they were comfortable with previously. So that's a weird sort of thing that I've noticed.
I'll give you my. Go ahead.
I think is due to autocorrect.
Right. So my one, really, I only have one autocorrect story, but it's a good one. So one day I had I think it was just a regular appointment with my doctor, you know, like once a year or whatever it was. And so I sent a text message to my wife that was supposed to be FYI, going to see my MD. But I later found out that what she received was dying. Going to see my MD. it had autocorrected FYI to dying. I have no idea why to this day.
Bit of a difference there. It knew more about what was going on with you than you did.
And I think the other thing, you know, related to this with keyboards, which is really about text input, is that, you know, another big change in 2007, 2008, text input was the most important thing that people use these mobile devices for. Text messaging was somewhat new, but email, instant messaging, and that is certainly in the United States. Today, it's all about graphics, and in particularly to selfies. So we've gone from SMS in 2007 to selfies today, right? It's the camera, taking pictures, even, you know, emojis, which is all graphical. It's a much more graphical type of medium of communications today. And probably the photos and the selfies are almost become the most important feature of the smartphones than the keyboard and the text input.
And of course, the weirdest thing to me is people taking photos of text. You know, like clever sayings that are for some reason printed in just plain text. And they take a photo of it and post that. I think that's a Twitter thing because you have a limited amount of text you can post. But
I think it's also I found this sort of thing and not an I made it up sort of thing. Like some of the things that I see people posting on that, you could easily retype yourself. But it's almost, I think, showing, well, look, I found this. I'm not responsible for the stupidity of it or something like that. You were talking about the Sidekick data loss, which I had forgotten about that story. So I just kind of looked up some of the stats on it. That was one of my favorite advices that Microsoft ever gave out to people, which was do not turn your device off.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It was if you turn your device off, you will lose things. Keep it on, keep it charged, and when we get our servers back up and running, everything will be good and you can reboot then. But don't turn it off. And, of course, I had forgotten about this. The article I just found on PC World, the subheading was bad news for Windows Mobile, because the week that this data loss happened was during the same week that Windows Mobile 6.5 devices were launched. So it was, will Microsoft get some kind of blowback from Sidekick data having their name in the news for a massive data loss on one phone platform? Will it affect their other phone platform? And in the end, it probably didn't matter because I don't think many people bought Windows Mobile 6.5 devices anyway. So,
and you know, in fact, as a Windows Mobile fan back then, I mean, basically I was using a Windows Mobile phone and so forth. I refused to upgrade to Windows Mobile 6.5 because I thought it was so awful. It had a hexagonal user interface, if I recall correctly, which never made sense then, doesn't make sense now.
It looked cool.
Dumbest UI I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen a lot of dumb UI, but that was absolutely hideous. Almost unusable, I would say, for somebody who expects to see. I mean, we all grew up expecting to see a tiled icon interface, right? It doesn't matter if it's an iPhone, an Android, or Windows Mobile. It's X and Y rows. There's no hex rows. But in any case, it drove me nuts.
And so related to that, then I think is the other interesting trend when I was thinking about this in preparation for this podcast, and that is the overall size of the device. And I think back to my history with these types of devices, which goes back to the Newton Message Pad. And the Newton Message Pad, I think, was practically a 6-inch diagonal, maybe even an 8-inch or something like that. It was a fairly large device to carry around. And in over time, Newton went away and it was replaced by Palm, which was a much smaller device. The Windows, the Pocket PCs, and all those were smaller devices. So we went from fairly large down to small. I mean, and then that time the flip phones became popular, and there weren't, size, getting things to be as small as possible was the whole challenge.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the case when the iPhone was introduced, as you mentioned, in the G1 with its small 3-inch screen. And now here we are. I'm walking around with my Nexus 6P with its 6-inch screen, and it dawned on me today that this is not that much smaller than my original Newton Message Pad, at least from a screen standpoint.
Right. It's so just right thinner.
Back to accepting this, it's much thinner, and obviously in color and all that. But we're back to larger devices being acceptable, probably because of how much we're trying to do with these things now.
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely the case, because when you talk about Palm, I remember back in the 2000, 2001, I had a Palm, I think M505 or something like that at that point. And it was a great device to carry around and use. The problem was no one else used it. And you'd get to these situations where it'd be really useful for everyone to pull out a Palm and start looking at their calendars, but yet one guy in the room would have a Palm and everyone else was using a paper calendar. And so slowly over time, that guy thought, well, I guess I'll just use what everyone else is using. I'll use the paper calendar too. This thing just takes up more space in my pocket and it's not really all that useful. So I think the big reason why devices shrunk and then got big again was they needed to kind of shrink down to capture, plus having a phone built into it, capture people saying, yes, this is a new thing that I should take with me everywhere. And then once they had that thing in their pocket, you could add all those things back in that Palm and Newton and everyone else was trying to do with their larger, clunkier, optional devices, now that you had a required device in someone's pocket.
But the interesting thing is that the legacy of these two operating systems from iOS and Android is a smaller screen. And I think it's still obvious. I mean, in iOS, I think it's very obvious now with the iPad Pro, right? To me, a large 12-inch screen. And from what I've been told, not all the apps take advantage of that screen. It looks like lots of wasted real estate, screen space and so forth. It just doesn't look right. And Android's the same way. I mean, even with my 6P, one of the first things I noticed is I have a number of widgets that, on my original Moto X with its 4.7-inch screen, I had widgets that went completely across the screen. Looked perfect. Those exact same widgets went about 3/4 of the way across the screen, and it doesn't look as good. So we still have, now that we kind of accept larger devices, but the operating system and the UI still has to kind of catch up. It'll be interesting to see, particularly I think with iOS, because it seemed to be most on the smaller screen size format, much longer than most, even though it had the iPad and everything. When are we going to start seeing maybe some changes from that grid layout, Todd, that you mentioned, to some other type of UI, perhaps maybe like with, Windows 10 phone edition or Windows 10 itself has? Who knows?
Well, I think adding on to that, since I have an iPad Pro, I definitely think that it's going to be about a year before all the major third parties have updated and are using the latest version of Xcode and they have the right keyboard and everything else put in. But thankfully, Apple does a pretty good job of motivating developers by making it really annoying to stay on the old tools. Whereas Google, as a developer there, I can still use the old tools and still get them to run on a current device. Apple just kind of draws a line in the sand, says you're upgrading and all of your libraries are upgrading too. I think that's a hopeful thing. But I don't see Apple abandoning the grid, considering that on the 27-inch cinema display that I'm using right now for this call, if I bring up Launchpad, I get a giant grid of wasted space that is comical to look at. I never use it. I launch all of my apps by using Spotlight Search and typing the first couple letters of them and then hitting enter. But I guess for whatever reason, Apple is in love with that grid. I do not see them abandoning it anytime soon.
You know, and as a relatively happy Windows 10 user, I should say, I don't think I want to see that on a phone. I mean, I know what the Windows Phone looks like, and I know it's not quite what Windows 10 looks like, but I find it hard to identify which tile is what app in Windows 10. You know, sometimes I'm like looking for the store, and, you know, they're always changing the picture on it. So it's like, okay, what does it look like now? Similarly for the photo app and things like that. So I don't think the grid is going to go away either quite yet. But if it does, my guess is, and it's just a guess, that we may see something new if, as rumored, Google actually starts merging the Chrome OS and Android OS together. And according to rumor, we'll see it as early as next year. So we may see something emerge. Maybe at the next what does Google call their developer Google I/O?
Yes.
Google I/O in the spring.
Yeah, that's hard to. I guess it's hard for me to imagine how that would affect the mobile devices that we're talking about. I see that announcement more to do with the more traditional desktop and notebook type of devices than the smartphones and tablets that we've been talking about. I still think, you know, it's kind of interesting to wonder whether we're at the limit of what you can do from a user interface standpoint for these devices, or imagine what could possibly be next. I mean, Google has done a lot to try to introduce voice into the UI scenario as an avenue, and that may be one approach. I don't know. I mean, if we think out 7 years from now and where things are going to be, while I would certainly believe that Android and iOS are going to continue to be around, I don't know. I'd almost be disappointed if they look the same as the way as they look today.
Well, you know, iOS hasn't changed significantly on the front homepage, at least, since version 1.
Right.
So at least iOS will probably look the same. unless Johnny Ive goes, I don't know, I guess he's really not head of UI anymore. But, you know, whoever is head of UI has some really dramatically different ideas that gets through Tim Cook. If I see change, I expect to see more on the Google side than the iOS side. But that's just a guess. I have no insider knowledge at all. And I say that partially because I still, you know, from day one, having looked at the G1, I said, boy, I wish this thing were bigger. I wish this were a tablet, you know, or something with a keyboard. Actually, I said I wish it was a notebook, a small, lightweight notebook. And I still would like to see – I know there are some Android notebooks out there, but I want to see a good one. The ones I've seen don't look so good. They're running like version 4 or whatever of Android OS. They're very old, and they've never been updated. So I'd like to see a Nexus notebook that's got the merged Chrome OS, Android OS. Hybrid.
That's what you are probably likely going to see at IO 2016. I would think that's got to be what they mean about merging Chrome and Android, is some type of a 2-in-1 like device or a full-on notebook type of device.
Yeah. On the other hand, I also would, you know, Android today has so much fragmentation. I would hate to see it become even more fragmented with a tablet notebook kind of hybrid OS and a phone still being just Android. So I would hope that they figure out a way to merge it across their line.
Well, I mean, in all honesty, at the end of the day, under the hoods, you have basically Linux.
Yes.
Both Android and Chrome OS.
Yes.
Chrome OS is really just the Chrome browser interface on top of a Linux kernel.
Yes, Linux running one app.
With a taskbar down at the bottom of the screen. That's Chrome OS. I don't know. I have a hard time seeing, aside from the update model, what Chrome has for updating apps in the operating system is far more elegant than Android. It gets pushed out instantly. It happens quickly. You just do a quick reboot and off you go. Right? That's much better than Android. Now, it's much less, you know, it's much lighter than Android as far as the amount of code and everything being updated. So that is, in my mind, that's the big value that comes into Android, is if somehow that's incorporated. Otherwise, to me, Android's a much more robust operating system. So I have a hard time seeing what the end result would be of the merger of those two.
Yeah, I don't understand either. I mean, my question is, well, can't you already run Chrome on Android? And the answer is yes, because that is the browser. So we'll have to wait and see. I guess we're a couple months, maybe half a year away from Google I.O. So we should see that, you know, next 6-7 months, I guess, if anything, if the rumor turns out to be true. I did have one more question before both of you guys, and that's, so Frank, what happened after the G1? What did you use after the G1?
I think it's the Nexus One. I honestly can't remember. I have every model of Nexus I bought until the Nexus 4 came out, and then I skipped the Nexus 4 and the Nexus 5. I believe.
Yeah, I think you were a Motorola
user. The original
user.
Nexus 5. Yeah, well, I hopped on to what happened is I switched from Nexus to the HTC One, the original one.
Oh, interesting.
Which I think, frankly, is still probably the most elegant piece of hardware that I've used for Android. The 6P is very nice, but that original Nexus One was a beautiful phone. I mean, just physically a beautiful phone. And basically, I used that for a while until I switched back to when I got the Moto X. And then, of course, now from the Moto X, I'm back to the Nexus.
And how about you, John? What did you do after you abandoned Windows Mobile?
Oh, I went a lot of places.
You're like
got
Dr.
the
Seuss.
MyTouch. Yeah, I went to the MyTouch 3G, which was the HTC Magic. That was the next T-Mobile Android phone after the G1. In fact, I still have a Fender guitar version of that lying around here somewhere that my wife used for a while. Then I think my next jump was, I still was buying some Windows Mobile devices at that time. So I think I had the Dash 3G, the HTC Maple for a while. And then I bought the Nexus One. That was another one. Then the Nexus S and the Nexus Galaxy. The T-Mobile G2, which was the HTC Desire Z, was one of my daily drivers. I love the G2. And my last daily Android driver was the Nexus Galaxy before I jumped briefly to the iPhone 5, 4S and then the 5 about a month and a half later. In fact, my question for both of you, I would kind of assume, this, if this isn't true, then go ahead and discount it, that your favorite Android device that you've ever used might be your current generation, but what is your favorite Android device? Because for mine, it was the G2. I love the little sliding keyboard. I love the fact that you have a removable battery. You could have a spare battery with me. I like the touchpad on it. But what is, for both of you, your favorite Android device that you've ever used?
Frank, why don't you go ahead? I think you said yours, but go ahead.
I think from a physical standpoint, obviously, I really like that HTC One. That was probably one of my favorites. I am very happy with this 6P, though. So the HTC One was definitely the best looking phone. Probably from a functionality standpoint, at this point in time, the 6P is the best one to date.
Yeah, and for me, and I should say after the G1, which I returned, I got a Motorola Droid, which to me kickstarted the Android movement. You know, the G1 was not a big seller, and Android itself was not a big seller until Motorola and Verizon teamed up with that gigantic $100 million Droid commercial, if you guys remember that. And the Motorola Droid, I thought, was the first good Android phone, but it wasn't great. I think, like Frank, Frank mentioned, he didn't name it as his favorite, but one of his favorites, the Nexus One was the first Android phone. I said, wow, this is a great phone. It was a great size. It's palmable in one hand. You don't feel like, you know, you have to be a 6'7" basketball player to hold it comfortably. It had a nice screen. And that wasn't great, of course. You know, this is several years ago. It was reasonably fast. It had, I think, Frank or John, one of you two, mentioned that it had the trackball, the tricolor trackball. I think John mentioned that. I really liked it. I mean, obviously, it started failing early because it simply didn't have enough system RAM and system storage to upgrade the apps on it. But other than that, you know, for its time, I think that was the thing that said, oh, okay, now Android is serious. With the Nexus One, Android is a serious platform now.
Yeah, and I was looking back, I was digging into the drawer of the phones I have, and somewhere along the line, I guess in 2010, I had a little interlude of going back to Windows Phone, because I have an HTC HD 7 that looks like was probably introduced in the 2010 time frame.
That sounds about right.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, I've got one of those around here too somewhere.
I don't know if I use this as my full-time daily driver or if I just got it to try out the last version of Windows Phone that I probably used.
Yeah, and I have to say the HD 7 was the last Windows Phone I used. Actually, it was the first phone I used too. and I used it for about 2 years. And I'll tell you why. It had a great Bluetooth stack. To this day, none of my phones, Android or iPhone, has a Bluetooth stack that worked as well with a, you know, car speakerphone system as Windows Phone did. So I kept that for a long time until 2012, I think, when I finally gave up on Windows Phone and moved to the Nexus 4. Yeah, Nexus 4.
Yeah, no, this sorry, is a fun. Nice. Yeah. I mean, this is a. I mean, HTC has made some very good hardware over the years. In fact, the Nexus One is an HTC phone, and you know, just looking at this, it's got a really great feeling. It's got a neat little kickstand on here. I almost forgot it had.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very handy. Okay, well, I'm gonna bring this podcast to a close in a minute. I just want to mention a couple of things that we were going to talk about, except this one, we had so much fun on just this one topic. A couple of things I'll probably talk about a little later. The Raspberry Pi Zero, the $5 Raspberry Pi that was just released this past week. Kind of interesting. And it was also apparently inspired by Eric Schmidt, who we mentioned earlier, who told, what is his name? Eben Upton? I forget his name. The guy who creates Raspberry Pi that... Don't make a more expensive Raspberry Pi. He was thinking about doing a $50 one. Make a cheaper one, which he did. $5. That's about as cheap as you can get. In fact, I think shipping is $7 if you buy it in the U.S. From Adafruit, one of those places. So the shipping is actually more expensive, over 100% more expensive than the device itself. But, of course, you're still talking about a $13, you know, $11, $13 total cost for this functional computer. So kind of interesting. Something I need to figure out, so it's probably best I don't talk about it yet, is WordPress moving away from PHP to pure JavaScript, which kind of bothers me, actually, but might be a good time to jump WordPress for myself since I've been thinking about that. And Apple not having its own Black Friday sale. Perhaps marketing pundits can explain that to us later on, so I'll just keep an eye on that. They allowed their, I don't know if allowed is a word, but basically the brick and mortar stores like Best Buy and Target had iPad sales and so forth, but Apple itself, no Black Friday sale, which is, I think, the first time ever. And it's too bad because I was looking forward to buying an iPad Mini 4 through Apple, but I didn't have that opportunity. So I'll wait till Cyber Monday to see if Apple does anything and then debate what I'm going to do next. In any case, I want to thank John Westfall and Frank McPherson to celebrate the 7th anniversary of the Mobile Views podcast, which started in November 2008, 1 month after the G1 launched. We had a nice chat about the G1, Android in general, where it's been, where it's is, not so much maybe where it's going with the rumored merger with Chrome OS. Again, that's just a rumor. We don't know. And I have an article on extremetech.com about that. Some of my questions about how the heck they're going to do that. Anyway, John, thank you.
No problem. Anytime.
Frank, thank you for coming on board. I know you've got a busy schedule, so thanks for joining us one more time. And on this special occasion.
You're welcome.
And we will talk to you next time.